Thanks. I'm very happy to be here and be a part of this program you have to bring journalists in. It's a great idea, and it's a, I think, I understand why it's done. Years ago, some scientists, I'm sure it was a physicist, told me that the way to make progress in science is to make all possible mistakes as fast as you can. And so it only stood to reason that if you got a journalist in, that would help you speed up your progress. Today I want to talk about the basic principles of science journalism, kind of as a way of providing just a baseline of understanding of what science journalism is and all of what it's all about. And I will try to make it clear as I go the difference between the way it is and the way it ought to be. Mostly what I'll be saying is what I think science journalism should be and how it should be and what principles it should be based on. And there is some overlap with what I think and what other science journalists think, but it's not a 100% overlap. And there are things that are done in the science journalism world that I disapprove of even more than most scientists do. But on the whole, there are some basic principles that most good science journalists at least share, and I think that these are good starting points for further discussions that we can have while I'm here the rest of the time. Before I go to the first principles of science journalism, I think we have to start with the first principle of journalism. And this is actually where all the trouble begins. Public has the right to know is, I believe, the best way to express the first principle of journalism. And when I talk to scientists, as I've had many times in the past, and started out saying that, you hear mutterings in the audience, and people get all concerned. And then they really get concerned when I tell them what the first principle of science journalism is, which is, or first principle of purpose is to tell the public what scientists are doing. And then you start hearing them saying, I knew it, they're out to get us. Really, I've had people, when I've said that, that's been the response. And, or maybe they waited until I said the next part, which is when I mean tell the public what scientists are doing with their tax dollars. Then they really do. But it doesn't really, and of course the fact that it's done with tax dollars is relevant, but it doesn't really matter whose dollars you're using to do it. It's still important for the public, and it's important for the public to know what you're doing. And it should be good. It should be good. It shouldn't be necessarily bad for the public to know what you're doing. And this is what I try to say. I say, hey, the point is, to the extent that science does good things, then telling the people about it should accrue to science's benefit. So, it shouldn't be a bad thing. It should be a good thing all the way around. But I get in response people who will say, actually, shouldn't science journalism exist to promote science? And the answer to that is no. In fact, science journalism or journalism of any sort in a democratic society is not supposed to be promoting things. It's supposed to be letting the public know things. And again, if science is doing good things, it should have some of that effect. It can, you know, have that effect indirectly. And, you know, and that's fine if it has that effect indirectly. If by telling people about science it has the effect of promoting science, then that's fine. But that will depend not on, you know, the journalists changing their purpose for what they're doing, but it'll depend on what scientists is actually doing. You know, and the journalists should tell what scientists are doing accurately and fairly. Another common question or complaint is the purpose should be science education. Journalists should be in the business of science education. The answer to that is no. That's not what, journalists aren't any good at education anyway. That's not what they're there for. Education, you know, is an educational system's job. And you know, even if science journalists wanted to do science education, I mean, how could we possibly do it? I mean, when I used to write, I mean, I wrote a column every week. I had 800 words a week. And, you know, the school system can't educate people, you know, for, you know, all day for every day for 12 years. My 800 words a week, if even if that was what I was trying to do, it wouldn't work. I mean, it doesn't work. You can't have these multiple purposes. Our purpose as science journalists is to tell people what's going on, what science are doing. Now, but it can have a science education benefit indirectly also. And I saw this a lot when I wrote in Dallas for the schools. Every time I would visit a school, the science sections in my columns and stories would all be posted on all the bulletin boards in the science classrooms. Teachers would, you know, force the kids at gunpoint to read the science section every week to show them what was going on. And that, it helps generate interest. It helps generate relevance of their science classes, which can have a beneficial effect for science education. So there's all kinds of benefits that you can get. But if you start confusing the basic principles and purposes, you're going to end up with, you're going to lose that benefit as well, because you're not going to do something well if it's not the the purpose for what you're supposed to be doing. So as that, you know, as a foundation, the very first principles, then I will go on now to discuss some of the other general principles that science journalists do or should use in going about their work, in particular aspects of their work. Things, what it's all about, understanding and identifying what's news, what's how you gather it, how you write it. And then the last part of my talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think needs to be done about this disconnect, this lack of overlap between how things ought to be and how things today really are. So, additional principles, or, you know, you could call these principles or values. My wife always is saying the problem with journalists is they have no values. They just want to, you know, write what's going on. And I said, no, that's not right. At least science journalism, we have two values. Well, I have two values that I think everybody else should have. One is your four factual accuracy. Now, you know, that ought to be something that should go unstated, but it's not always the case. I mean, I run into a lot of people, journalists included, who don't value factual accuracy all that much. I mean, you know, I criticize them severely, but there are people who say, it doesn't matter if you get it all right, you get the basic idea. Interesting story, I know that. That's fine. I mean, it should be four factual accuracy. Really, for science journalism to be good and succeed at communicating to the public about what science is doing, you really have to have that as a value. That should be something that every science journalist has at the top of the list. And you have to work really hard to achieve it, but it still should be something you have at the top of the list. Second, you should be against stupidity. And now again, this is another thing, some journalists, now you should write everything, you know, sorry, but that's not right. I mean, your first principle is tell the public what scientists are doing. That means to tell, give an accurate picture of what scientists are doing and about science. And you should not be in the business of disseminating incorrect information. You should be in the business of disseminating information that the readers, your audience, whose your purpose is this audience here, the public, that they can rely on. You want to provide information that's reliable. You want your readers to be able to read what you write about science and what science is doing and be able to believe it. And not be wondering, well, I wonder if that's just, they wrote that story about something that's nonsense, but, you know, they wanted to make a headline. Now, that's not a good principle. The principle is to be against the papers. And if you do your job well enough, you know it when you see it. There might be some times it was a little question, but usually it stands out. Now, another principle that you hear journalists mention a lot, which is, again, this is an area of a little bit of controversy. And so you should have balance. Okay, so should you have balance? You know, balance this side or the other side. And the answer to that question is C number two. Balance is one of the dumbest damn concepts ever introduced into the media. And you see people saying this all the time, from reporters up to the top editors of the top papers, that think balance is a proper value for journalism, and therefore they should be true in science journals as well. Well, it's nonsense. I mean, if you really tried to apply that principle to journal, what would you have to do? I mean, every time there was a space shuttle mission, you'd have to say it. However, some people say the Earth is flat. You know, it's just an absolute idiotic concept that is perpetrated as real journalism. Now, there are principles there that are true. I mean, now, if someone is accused of a crime or something, there is a principle that you need to give the accused the right to reply and, you know, defend themselves. I mean, I'm not saying that you don't do that. I mean, there's certain principles of fairness that apply if you're writing about aspects of things and that are directly affecting some person or group, and you have an obligation to get their comment and everything. So, I mean, it's not, you just don't write whatever the hell you want. But the correct concept here is not balance, but in science journalism, that independent comment is an important principle. When you have a story that comes out in the paper about science, some paper comes out saying something, you'll see, you know, some of the non-science journals and others, well, you got to get somebody to give the other side. No, that's not. You get somebody who's in a position to assess this report with some perspective to provide some comment. They might think it's really good. They might think it's really bad. The point is not that you search the world for somebody who disagrees with the result. The point is you find someone who is in a position of knowledge and judgment to make an assessment of that report for you that can help you report to the readers what the significance or likelihood of this being worthwhile is. I mean, it's the point is getting somebody who's not part of the research itself, but someone who is knowledgeable enough in a position to make a comment, to make the comment. But you will run into people where editors will say, no, you got to go find out somebody who thinks it's wrong to, you know, find the other side. And that's, you know. Now, as a good science journalist, if you're doing your job, you need to find out, is there a significant difference of opinion on this issue within the legitimate scientific community, among the people who are knowledgeable in the field? I mean, you don't necessarily just pick anybody out at random to give the comment and say, they say this, okay, that's fine, if you know that there are other people who are knowledgeable who would have a different point of view. But the point is, you don't search for somebody just to find an opposite point of view.
Tom,
yes?
Before you go, I mean, you're presenting your principle.
Yeah.
If I look at what comes out,
yeah,
the passage for science journalism in this country, I would say, you know, number one, headlines that promise life forever and eternal hell. Go for the headline. Number three, controversy and, you know, the headline is worth more than being against avidity and tongue.
Yeah, there's
another set of values at work.
Yes, that's true. There's a lot of that's and for the most part, although not totally, for the most part, the science journalist set of values differ from the rest of the journalist set of values in these respects. Now, there are some science journalists who fall into that bogus first category, but for the most part, it's a conflict between the other journalists and the science journalists. So, most science journalists would be pretty much in line with me on this, even though there you find a few who would, you know, not follow these principles well. Most would call my it's the other editors, other journalists at the paper where the conflict. So that's correct.
Is conflict with other journalists or with the publishers and the editors?
Well, with other journalists is primarily where the conflict is. I mean, yeah, every once in a while a publisher's attitude gets involved, but not that often. I mean, the publisher's pretty much out of the loop in stuff at this level of the data stuff. Except, you know, maybe in the sense of at budget time when they're allocating resources and stuff. But it's other journalists. There are always some other journalists who appreciate and understand this, but most of the other journalists, yeah, the controversy, the headlines, the get somebody who says the opposite kind of thing, let's make some controversy if there isn't even some to begin with. Yeah, a lot of other journalists are the ones that you have to fight with if you're doing the science journalist values. So, for a lot of these, though, it's something that if you really got a hold of one of these other journalists and you started talking it through with them, they could see that ultimately getting things right was what they were supposed to be for. It's just in general practice and what gets rewarded and what gets attention kind of skews things away from those foundational principles, which is why if you read the New York Times Ombudsman column where he talks about how, well, they forgot their policy on this and did something they shouldn't do because of these other pressures. But if you really get back to what the basics should be, they would agree more with this. But then the idea of independent comment is, of course, just basic traditional journalism principle. It's just that in a lot of areas, and in some areas it makes more sense. If you're having debates on political issues and things about should we do this and should we not do this or should people vote for this or not, then it makes sense to go find people who are on both sides in those contexts. When you're asking a question about, you know, what's the value of some fundamental constant or something, it doesn't make sense to go find somebody who just doesn't agree with what the measurements are. One point about the independent comment, another thing about this is you have to make sure that you let people speak for themselves. Sometimes science journalists, you know, will quote the person doing a study and then say, well, what do you people who disagree say? Well, they say this, and that's what they put in for the other side. Well, you know, that doesn't. We got to go actually find the people who are independent to give the comment, not take one person's word for what somebody else would say. Now, the controversy part, the way I was going to bring that up is sensationalism, which sometimes involves controversy, sometimes involves just blowing things out of proportion for the sake of making it seem like a better story, and some writers and even some science writers will do that, but I do not like that as a principle. I would suggest that maybe enthusiasm in the writing of science is okay, and in fact, you know, this is, if you're going to give people a reason to read what you've written, you need to have a reason to write it, and if there's a reason to write it, it should be written in a way that conveys that it's something worth writing and worth reading. And so the way I would look at it is writing it enthusiastically, making it interesting and appealing, while adhering to the principles of accuracy and all that is fine. I think what one way of looking at that and a good principle to have is context is always important in reporting these things. And this is one of the areas where the logistics of the news media and the way things operate, especially newspapers, but also TV and things, working on a daily basis, and the way the scientific journals present the stuff to you to cover, everything comes out as though it were this isolated, independent, new finding that here you write it today, and it's an addition to the textbooks that, you know, we can all click off. But then everybody recognizes that 2 weeks later, some other story comes out that says the opposite, and, you know, TV comedians make jokes about it and stuff, but it's a distortion of presenting what science is and what science does to do it in this way, but it's kind of, you know, an artifact of the way the media operate on this daily news cycle.
Isn't part of the problem here that journalists or most media, daily media, find it difficult to write anything that isn't quote unquote news?
Yes.
And that you have to, in the case of reporting on science, you have that simply, you know, as you say, there's no one day in which things that happen in science is news. You have to come up with an arbitrary definition of when it is news.
Correct.
For some reason, it's evolved that science and nature have defined when news occurs in science. Mm-hmm. Like when they publish their articles, some of us think that,
that
has nothing to do with when arbitrary.
Right. That's exactly right. And that has happened. That's the way the system has evolved. It's probably evolved that way because that's what's easiest for everybody. But the point is, you do have to, if you're writing in the news media, come up with a way to define something as being new in order to be able to write it. And I'll get to that in a little more detail. Even when you do it this way, though, my point, my principle, which I think should be observed, is you have to work in some context to try to tell people how what you're reporting fits into the bigger picture. It's very hard to do in the amount of space you have in a daily newspaper story to do that. That's why I've long been an advocate of having science sections in newspapers where you can come back afterwards and say, okay, here's a longer story that takes this new result and says, what happened before, what else is going on now, how does it fit into the big picture? But it's hard. Science sections are all getting killed for economic reasons, so it's harder to do. But this leads into the idea of what is news, though, and how you identify things as news. One last principle which leads into news is what I will call salience. A lot of people will use the word relevance. You know, it should be relevant. What you put in the newspaper still needs to be relevant to people. And I just don't like the word relevant. Salience, to me, captures it a little more precisely in that various people, various segments of the audience will take note of different things because for some reason or another, it's something they have an interest in or something that affects their lives or something that they've heard about somewhere else or whatever. But you want to find things that are salient to your audience, and that's to put it in the general media outlet. Now, so this, what makes something worth writing? What does a journalist look for? And there are basically three questions you ask about anything, about whether it's worthwhile. Is it new? Is it interesting? And is it important? Now,
I can ask about the first 7 points.
Yeah.
Here that they apply equally well to any other type of journalism, say politics, art. And what is intrinsic to science that made those practical?
Really nothing. I mean, you're right. They should apply to all the rest of journalism. If I were in charge, they would. But there's the primary difference is really this balance question on the type of story or type of thing you're reporting about, where in some context and some situations, balance in the sense that other people talk about it really probably is appropriate. In science journalism, balance is not appropriate the way it's usually used. You don't try to find something that's wrong to balance something that's right. You try to find out what's really the case. But no, it's true. I mean, these principles should apply to all journalism. it's, this is exactly what it should be.
So is the context, providing context, not somewhat in conflict with your statement that the goal of science reporting is not to educate? Because, I mean, in journalism, in a lot of times, so even let's talk about politics, if they're reporting on, say, the Iraq War, and they don't mention the context, which is that how did he get to power in the first place, which is did the U.S. prop him up or not, and so on. And similarly, in context in science education, in science reporting, the context might be if they're reporting on some new technological device, they might have to say, well, the physics groundwork was laid for it.
Right.
No, it's physics-based, and that's...
It's not in conflict with principle. My principle allows things to have the effect of improving education and literacy and promoting science and all that. It's just that that's not what you're setting out to do. You're not setting out to educate people. You're setting out to tell people what's going on. Well, telling people what's going on properly should require giving them some context. And if that has the effect of improving education, that's fine. It's just, you're not, that's not why you're doing it. You're doing it, you're informing, not educating, telling people what's going on. The context is an important part of telling them what's going on in an accurate way. Now, these three considerations here are basic to most all journalism as well. This is a case where you're trying to maximize the score on each of these scales. Whenever you know, the best stories that you can find to write are the ones that rate high on all three areas. Now, sometimes, you know, if something is really, really high on the interesting scale, maybe it's not so important, but it's, you know, you can still write a story. I mean, that's the, you know, cute animal stories, okay? Sex, there's nature is really big. If they have any sex angle on anything they're publishing, that comes to the top of their tip sheet they send out. You know. But, you know, sometimes there are certainly stories that just are fascinating, interesting stories, without being terribly important, but they are likely to get written. One of the reasons is, again, the other editors at the paper who, you know, allocate your space are likely you're going to have a better chance selling them something that's about a cute animal, probably. I mean, that's not necessarily good, but that's part of the way things are. On the other hand, some stories are just extremely important, although they're not maybe so fascinating, but you still would like to try to do those in. It's a combination of these things. As David mentioned, can be defined in many different ways, and as a journalist, what you're trying to look is for some way, if you find something that's really important and really interesting, or high on one of these scales, okay, now how can I figure out a way to make this be new, too, so I can get it in the paper? Well, see, this is why the journal system works, because the journals, I can say, this was published today. That's all I need. That's what you call a news peg. So that's, you know, a news peg is kind of whatever lame excuse you can come up with that makes it sound like it's new. Or, you know, you can say, oh, well, here's something that's been going on for years, but I haven't written about it yet, but there's a conference next week and somebody's going to talk about this topic. I could say, this topic is being discussed next week in Santa Barbara or wherever. And that's an excuse for making it new. So a lot of times the new is artificial. But in something like science, which is just an ongoing thing, you have to come up with something artificial most of the time to give yourself the excuse for writing. So, I mean, it can be new also legitimately, like it could be something that's just never happened before, some totally new thing, you know.
But often, there's another way I've noticed that news is defined. The New York Times reports.
Well, yes, I could have said that there are some, one of the definitions of news is it hasn't been reported yet anywhere. Not, it could have been going on for 100 years, but if nobody's written about it yet, then it can still be considered new. Now, the New York Times often, I think, if they haven't written about it, they consider it new. Whereas the rest of us can't think if anybody has written about it, then it's not new anymore. So one of the questions journalists are always likely to ask is, has anything about your research been written anywhere, published anywhere, you know, in any news media before? You know, I see a lot of scientists, oh yeah, it was in USA Today a year ago, and it was in this other paper. And then the journalist goes, okay, bye. You know, it's like, that's not what you want to hear.
I noticed that the New York Times reports on something for the first time. Mm-hmm. Then all over other newspapers will either carry the time service, but often just write independent stories.
Follow it up. Or sometimes it's somebody else writes it first, and the Times then follows it up, too. But that doesn't happen anymore. No, that's true. I mean, people, then they find their excuses, their lame excuse to make some other news peg to kind of follow it up. But, so, I mean, there's an artificiality about defining what's new. But, you know, that's really okay. I mean, you have to, in a situation like this, find ways to make... This is part of the salience for the reader thing. Why should a reader want to read this? Well, if you can show them that something is going on, it's a live thing. That's happening, something about it is happening now, today or next week or something. That's an important part of attracting the reader. And you know, a lot of journalism, science journalism, is about this. I mean, a lot of scientists don't see the reason for some of the things we have to do. But first thing you have to do is get people's attention. You have to get people's attention. And if you don't get their attention, all the great stuff you're going to say afterwards is just going to be wasted. So, and showing why something is new and salient and current is part of that. So it's new for various reasons, obviously interesting for various reasons. Importance can be a lot of things. It can be if it affects a lot of people, that's something that's going to kill a lot of people, you know, or cure a lot of people, or it's something that's going to make a lot of money for somebody. Any of those obvious things, but whatever it is, I mean, you want to convey that's part of what you want to look for to get a idea of what's a good story. Now, I also need to say, I mean, there are different kinds of stories. There's the daily story, which is, you know, the out-of-context story. There's the feature story that, in my way of looking at things, should be an opportunity for bringing some things together, putting some things in context. The feature story can be various other types, too. Of course, it can be just... some interesting story about how research was carried out, you know, doesn't have to always be the results. There also should be more of what I will call enterprise or investigative stories, where instead of just taking what the journals spoon feed to you, what you know you get in the press releases or whatever, you actually go out and do some investigating to find out what's going on that nobody else has noticed and put some things together. So there's a real lack in science journalism. There is some of this, of course, but not nearly as much as there ought to be, for as important as the issues are and as important it would be for the public to know and get more deeper, reliable information about these issues. So, I need to move on to these last 2 points to make, but I don't have enough time to go into all the detail I'd like to. But reporting and writing then, once you've got all these principles mastered, how you go about actually doing this job. And reporting is all about, you know, finding out what's going on. Your principal back here, you know, telling the public what scientists are doing. How do you find out what scientists are doing? Well, obviously, what the journals are telling you every week that they're publishing is one major source. The main journals, the media journals like Science and Nature, the New England Journal of Medicine, and over the last few years, a lot of journals have added themselves to that list by giving reporters advance information about what's coming out, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Cell and Neuron, all these other Nature sub-journals. And so there's a lot of journals that tell you what's going on. And you have a lot of news releases that are posted from people in universities and other organizations about what work is coming out in the more obscure journals that you don't see the journal. There are also, of course, events to cover. There's, you know, space shuttle launches coming up, and there's missions, planetary missions, and, you know, there's a fair amount of event coverage. There's also, of course, the online sources of information now, like the preprint servers, like the archive in physics, which is becoming more and more widely used. There are, you know, people at meetings. There is still some coverage. Meetings are not covered as well or as much as they used to, though. A lot of that is because of travel budgets being cut back, so people can't go to as many meetings. 34 years ago, meetings were the prime source of science news reports and newspapers, and journals have totally taken over that. And there are also, of course, you know, spin-offs from other things in the news that have a science component that reporters then, you know, make calls to find out about the science component. But this is, you know, there are a lot of ways to find ideas for doing science stories. And, you know, good science journals just find them whatever ways they can. Talking to scientists, you know, visiting them and asking what's going on. Going to web pages and looking at pages for various labs to see what research is being discussed. Seminar calendars. This is a really good place to go. You know, you go to various research institutions, look at their colloquia and seminar calendars and see who's talking about what. So there's a lot of ways to find out what's going on. Now there's a second big part of reporting after that, you know, getting ideas is part one. Then there's evaluating. And this is a whole big, huge topic that would take a long time to talk about, but I just want to mention two primary points about this. One is there's some evaluation that has to go, that goes on and should go on, that good science journals should do, just on the basis of, you know, looking at the logic and rhetoric of the paper, for example, and does it make any sense? Do the numbers support the statements written in English? And, you know, if it's, you know, a good paper by a good group and a good journal, usually they do, but not always. You have to be alert for that kind of thing. The other whole realm, of course, is understanding the math and statistics that go into leading to the conclusions that the paper draws. And here most journalists are not well equipped. It's very important, if you're not well equipped, to know that you're not well equipped. That's the real serious problem. A lot of them don't. And this is a particular issue in things like medical and health reporting, where conclusions are drawn and statements are made on the basis of statistics that are really, really misleadingly reported. And this is a big, huge area that there's a need for a lot of improvement. I did a seminar a few weeks ago, I'm going to do it again, on interpreting medical and health statistics for journalists that, you know, opened a lot of eyes about some of the issues that are involved in statistics and reporting science. And, yeah, even things like understanding basic things like confidence intervals and level of significance that most journalists don't have a very good grip on. That's a huge area of need for real improvement there. I would say one other thing about reporting and what's very, a really important part of this in doing this.
Talking about that, I had one.
Yeah.
At some point in polling data, mm-hmm. newspapers, the media have been forced to publish, or maybe the polling organizations, but the media as well, standard errors.
Right.
Somebody actually super looks at that, right?
Well, yeah, there was, you know, at some point in the process, and the New York Times started doing this really early, and so other people started following their lead and putting in the error margins and being careful about it. And they do that now, but most of them, they don't have any idea what it means or how to interpret it or how it should affect the interpretation of what they report.
Yeah, I know, but and they don't say, well, you know, but at least it's something.
It's a start.
Science reporters ever thought of doing that as well? Namely, when you report on a medical finding to say what the size of the sample was and what the standard deviation is, or whatever.
There are occasions where
you can have more serious consequences than publishing political forms.
There are occasions where I have seen people, or I've tried to do something along those lines, but you can't just put in there, here's the standard deviation. I mean, that would be meaningless. You have to figure out some way to express that uncertainty in a way that makes sense. And there are certainly cases where that should be done, and a lot of times it isn't done where it should be done. But I mean, it is a tricky thing. And at this point, I just like to get people to know the difference between statistical significance and the magnitude of the effect. You know, people say that's very statistically significant. It was a tiny little effect. You just had a huge sample so you could get real significance out of a tiny effect. Well, what's important is the size of the effect and not to confuse the two. So it's a huge problem area, there's no doubt. Anyway, the last point about reporting developing sources is, this is really another, it's key to journalism, whatever kind you're doing, but it's very important. Good science journalists really need to work hard at developing sources in the areas they cover. They have to identify the people who are worth going to for help and for comment and for guidance. And you know, my rule of thumb is you want to find people with whom it is unwise to disagree. And sometimes that's for different reasons, but that is a guide that I think you want to be. You don't want to just be calling people at random for comments. You want to understand who the scientists are in various fields and who you can go to for reliable help. Source development is a really big area of reporting. Now, time is running out, so I won't have as much time as I would like to talk as much as I would about writing, but I'm sure this will come up in one of the Friday afternoon sessions. There are some basic principles of writing about complicated things that apply to science journalism, to all journalism, and ought to apply to scientists writing their papers too, but you know, that's not what I'm going to be able to solve today. But the idea of simplify the complex is at the core of writing science journalism. Don't forget, this is a principle still here. I don't mean by simplifying the complex that you make it wrong in order to make it simple, which is why it's harder to do. It's easy to make it simple if you don't care about keeping it right, which is what a lot of people do, and which a lot of editors like. Man, that guy writes stuff that's so clear and understandable. Why can't you write stuff that's clear and understandable? Well, if you don't care what's right, I can write some really simple stuff. But it's an important principle. It has to be done for this to be done well. This is why, I mean, you hear advice, use short words and use short sentences. And, you know, it is important to use short words and short sentences. It doesn't mean every word has to be short and every sentence has to be short, but on average, in general, that's the idea of writing. Now, why is this? Well, this is kind of a marker for more complicated things. I mean, short words tend to be concrete as opposed to abstractions. Concrete words are better than abstract words. They communicate better. They're more visual, stuff like that. Short sentences are a good idea because that forces you to put your ideas out one at a time instead of a sentence that interpolates three or four intermediate ideas varying the point the sentence started out to make. Those are critical principles in writing and communicating. Another point that's a little less obvious, I think, is that you have to write using the reader's language. And even some journalists don't quite get this point. And a lot of scientists I've talked to in the past said, well, you know, if science education were better, people would learn all these terms, then we could communicate with them. Well, you know, that would be nice, I suppose, but in the interim, you're going to have to communicate to people with the language they already have. You can't just write a story, for example, and start to say, okay, here's some technical terms, here's what this means, here's what this means, here's what this means. Now start writing a story using all those technical terms, like, you know, they're old friends. You have to use the words that people already know. Now, my rule is you're allowed one. If you're writing a story about some new development, pick the one word that is the critical new word about this development, and then don't write a dictionary definition, but do some descriptive explanatory phrasing that gives them an idea what this word is all about. Then you use that word. Now, that doesn't mean you might not mention another term that's important, but you don't use those other terms. You might describe something, say, parenthetically, that's known as, you know, a boson, whatever. But you pick the one word that's most central to the story you're talking about to tell them about and use that. But otherwise, you have to use their own language. You have to relate unfamiliar things. I'm getting too low. Relate unfamiliar things to the familiar things. When you're writing, you gotta think about things that are familiar and how they might relate analogically to what you're writing about. I mean, you know, things like cars are good. Food is a good thing. It can relate to food. Money is often helpful. These are the principles of communicating that in your writing you have to use. You have to evoke images when you write. Use words that are visual. Use descriptions visual. I mean, this is the principle of good radio, right? When you're listening to the radio, if it's making a picture in your head, then it's good radio. Same thing works with writing. If the writing makes pictures in your head, it's reading, it's easier, you get it more, and that's sometimes the straightforward sentence can be easy enough to understand, but it can be non-visual. If you add a visual example or a metaphor or something, that really helps it out. The last point of writing that I'm going to make, not all there is about writing, but focus. Common complaint. Well, you left out this, or you left out that, or you didn't tell the whole story here, and blah, 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 blah. Well, that's right. Never tell the whole story. You have to, when you write a story, pick what you're going to focus on to write about, and that means some things are going to be left out. When you write, the rule here is, it doesn't fit, it must go in. Now, okay, just a couple minutes left. I don't have enough time left to really go into this, but what should be done about all this stuff? Why is, as some of you observed, so much of what I say not the way things really are? Well, one is there's a lack of good science journalists out in the world that are in a place where they can do good science journalism. There are a lot of good science journalists out there, more than you would suspect. Not that there aren't some bad ones, but there are a lot of good ones. A lot of them, though, haven't been as well trained as they might be. And a lot of them suffer from the pressures I talk about from other journalists that prevent them from doing what they should want to do. The truth is today that there are very few outlets for good science journalists to write the kinds of things the way I think they should be written, to do the kinds of things that I think should be done about communicating science to the public. What outlets used to be have either diminished in quality, or gone out of business, or succumbed to various kinds of pressures. Commercialism, I mean, commercial pressures have gotten so great, economic pressures have gotten so great, that doing things really well and right has gone out the window. It's the stuff you can do cheaply. A lot of places want to do science journalism, they want to hire the cheapest freelance people they can get, to throw anything up there on the web or whatever. They want to write different things. It's a bad situation. So what do I propose? I propose, and now this is totally off the wall, of course, and, you know, I'm not. I propose Institute for Theoretical Science Journalism. Now, you could maybe leave the theoretical out of there, and maybe you should be practical, I don't know. But anyway, you would have, you know, some permanent faculty. Some really top-flight science journalists who would be in a position here to, A, do some top-flight science journalism, and B, impart top-flight science journalism principles to others. they, you know, you'd have, they would be like your visitors, who would come for a period of time, and also practice the craft. We have, there are a number of science journalism programs in America. There's one at Santa Cruz, it's very good, that trains people who have science backgrounds to be science journalists. Boston University has one. But these people get this basic training in these places, and they come out looking for jobs, and they don't really have the skills at the instant they come out. Most of them have to go find internships where they learn the professional business a little better, and this would be a place where that could happen. So some of the visitors would be just your beginners, but some of them would be pros from other places, like people at newspapers where they rarely got to do big long things. They could take a sabbatical period and go to this institute, work on a good investigative piece for some length of time. And you could even have, I think, someplace like this, something like a scientist in residence who would learn a lot about the media and how science journalism worked and help out the journalists who were there. Now, there's an aspect to this where people could come even from other arenas and other fields, I think, to benefit. You could have, you know, a science teacher in residence, you could have a novelist in residence, you could have any number of people come here. I mean, Michael Crichton ought to come to some place like this and learn some science. You could have an operation here where science, new science, exciting science, interesting science is all being discussed and shared. And the benefit of this, and this is the thing I miss most about the paper, is you get a group of science journalists together with various specialties and bring together every week reports of all the stuff that's going on all over the place in all different science fields in one spot. And so much of that comes in, but so little of it gets out the way things are today. And if you had a place like this where it could get out to people who were visiting, it could get out in some media format. The key to this thing would be that it would actually be not just another school of journalism, but it would be a place that was producing some journalism. I mean, you might start out small with an online publication, but you'd ultimately want to have a print publication. You would want to have a place for these people to produce really top quality science journalism that was filling all these needs. I can imagine various things that could come out of this, like if you had screenwriters or people come like that for TV and things like that, or you could have people turning out like op-ed pieces on big issues that they came out to spread out to newspapers and stuff. There's all kinds of permutations you could imagine. But the point is that this is a very hard thing to imagine happening in the commercial world today, because the media outlets today have all these commercial pressures. So somebody has to come up with a model for getting some way of I think it's the scientific community, actually. Now, the journalism community isn't going to do something like this. I think the scientific community needs to somehow come together in a way and say, look, science is important. The public isn't finding out how important it is, what's going on, the way it needs to be done. And something needs to happen, because, I mean, things are bad. I don't think there's any doubt that things are bad. But this is my idea of something that, you know, it's remotely feasible. It could start on a very small scale and grow, I suppose. But anyway, so that's what I came to say.
Have you thought of a site?
Well, it would need a site. I think, you know, it would need some kind of the imprimatur of some organization. I don't think it could just pop up on its own in somewhere, probably. It would need some, you know, need somebody to cover the overhead, you know. But it's like, you know, an association with some kind of existing science-oriented operation, I think, would be good. Now, you know, it's, but it's I think it's clearly something that would be a beneficial thing, and it could work. But, you know, it's economics is, that's with everything else, is the issue.
So I see a very pro-technology society, but much less of a pro-basic science society at the moment. So where would you say the biggest responsibility, or at least the biggest changes need to take place, on the level of scientists doing science outreach, or science journalism, or politicians?
Well,
what needs to change?
Politicians, I think, are kind of hopeless, but that would be nice. There are some politicians, and sometimes when they kind of see that basic research issue, I think in this case the concept of the scientists and science journalists having a better interaction and a better framework for interaction with an appreciation of that basic research thing. This is a problem with newspapers and other commercial publications. Is people don't see the benefit of writing about basic research now. If I were to say, okay, what kind of a publication does this thing put out, I would think it would put out a publication or a web page or whatever with three components. One would be the news component, reporting science news, but with a twist that I think would be really critical, which is it should be critiquing the science news that's being reported everywhere else. This is something that's really missing. Is all this stuff goes out there, it's reported, some of it okay, some of it really bad, whatever. There's no place to find out what's the reliable reporting. And an operation like this could really do a service of reporting on the other reporter. The second big component would be that enterprise investigative component, where the big issues of the day would get some sustained attention with some actual, you know, science into the mix, as opposed to just talking heads on TV yelling at each other. And the third essential component would be what I would just label shorthand as the frontier feature component, which would be, this is the basic research component. This is where you go out and look, what is at the frontiers of basic research that someday may or may not, but has the potential of someday being in these other areas of big issues or impacting the economy or whatever. You can't, if you just do one or the other, you're missing out. You know, it's just like you say, well, we just want to fund, you know, applied medical research. Well, you know, you're missing out on all what really basic physical science research does to make all that applied research possible at some later time. And you've got to reflect that in this whole enterprise. So you've got to, it's a really important part. Science journalists would love to do that if anybody would let them do it. It's just harder and harder to get people to let you do it. So back here.
Yeah, I have some question about the kind of economical side of journalism. Mm-hmm. You know, we scientists and journalists have something in common. We both write papers and publish them, okay? But economic is quite different. Now, some of us have, you know, tenured faculty positions, we're paid for teaching or whatever, and not exactly per article, not paid per article, right? So question is, journalists, do they generally have, like, they are short-range writers at newspapers, so they have to write like weekly column or something, or they are freelancers, they just write a paper and try to, you know, send it out, and, you know, may not be accepted in different places?
Newspapers usually have staff writers who are paid to cover different areas and beats and write stuff. Well, every once in a while a newspaper might hire a freelancer to do something. Magazines is more likely to be the other way. Magazines only have some skeleton staff usually, and then they pay freelancers, they contract with freelancers to write specific articles for the magazines.
So the next question is that who's the idea, for example, for the paper? Is it the journalist comes up with the idea, comes to the editor, say, oh, this is interesting.
Either way, it works both ways. Lots of times, especially with magazine freelancers, freelancers will, you know, come up with an idea and they'll call or write different magazine editors and say, hey, I'd like to write about this, do you want it? And they'll say no. Sometimes the magazine editors will come across something they want, an article, and they'll call up a freelancer and say, would you like to write this? And you say yes. So it works both ways. But the, part of the problem is, of course, there are a lot of people out there trying to write freelance science, and there are very few places that will publish it, so it's really competitive to try to, for the limited amount of space, to get your story out.
Journalism has two sorts of components, not always very well differentiated. There's reporting and there's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And there are issues. Stem cell research is one mm-hmm. with scientific components, but which involve opinion writing. Who is around to write such things with the necessary scientific background?
Yeah, very, very few people have the background to write those opinion pieces intelligently. That's the problem. Now, you do get op-ed pages that will run things that are written, you know, by scientists or maybe ghostwritten for scientists. And so there's some of that that appears. But the regular writers on a regular basis, there aren't many who write that opinion. And that's one of the things I think is missing is, regular. I mean, wouldn't it be great if one of the Times regular weekly op-ed columnists was a science columnist, you know, and was writing on these issues from a really scientific perspective with, you know, well-informed information. But that's, you know, newspapers don't view things in quite that way. Although, you know, the weird thing is in other areas, they'll get an economist to write an op-ed column for them because economic issues are important. But I guarantee it never... They never dreamed of getting somebody with, you know, science background to write an op-ed column for them on it, because the science.
Has anyone ever proposed that?
I'm sure that people have mentioned that sort of thing to various people at various times, but you know, it's one of those things that you know isn't going to go anywhere, but, unless you know you happen to own the paper. I'd be shocked, but I mean it'd be great, but I'd be shocked.
A question, trying to understand why it is that most newspapers, if they drop their sports section, if they drop their business section, if they drop their fashion section, they lose a big chunk of advertising.
Mm-hmm.
But it appears to me that most newspapers can drop science writing and nobody seems to care. Why is there not a there should be a significant advertising contingent out there that actually cares about good science writing. A lot of industry is based on science. Why is it?
Well, that's a very key point because, you know, that's other sections in particular, things like travel sections or house and garden sections, things like that, have lots of pages because there's advertisers who advertise that. Why there are no science sections are all dying is because they never attract the advertisers. Why not? Well, organizations that ought to be buying those ads are clueless. They don't get it. And I've talked to a lot of people from a lot of organizations like this over the years. And I've talked to people like at IBM, people like at, you know, Dow Chemical, and people like at other companies of this nature. And you get various stories, but one is, you know, decisions falls to some advertising manager who's worried about, you know, his cost per thousand, he reaches this, and product sales things and this, and they don't see how this science section, if they're advertising that, that's going to help that. One is, the people who read science sections demographically and psychographically are big readers, and they read lots of things, and so the advertisers say, oh, our survey showed these people also read this where we already advertised, we don't need to advertise here again. So, which that all may be true, but my point is, now look, you know, you have an investment in having good science information out in the world and people reading about this and kids getting interested in science, blah, blah, blah. You should support it for that reason. And this is how you can, you know, manipulate the media, get the media to cover more science by saying, well, I'll buy ads in the science section. After all, you know, you spend millions of dollars for, like, your donations to science museums and things like that for that kind of purpose. And they'll say, well, that comes out of a different budget. And, you know, it's like, even though the top people in some of these organizations appreciate these things and think there should be more science coverage, it just doesn't translate down into people making decisions on spending the advertising money. I mean, it's kind of like the inertia of the system and the way things operate and tax laws or whatever else all conspire against it happening. So it just doesn't happen.
Okay, well, let's thank Tom for a very...